So this week we have a very unusual fast day. It's the only fast day that we can actually fast on Friday. So we're going to be entering Shabbos in a state of somewhat hunger, which is a short fast day. Just another trivia about Aseret B'Teves. It actually is the only Jewish holiday, or fast day, any holiday, that can sometimes be bypassed in a secular year. You can sometimes actually have a year, a 365-day period, which will not contain Aseret B'Teves. So this has happened, this could happen in years like this, although not this year. For example, Aseret B'Teves is sometimes, like this year, in December, and it can sometimes be towards the beginning of January, after the year after a leap year. So that would mean the following. You can have Aseret B'Teves, I think this happened in 1998. I don't remember the exact date, but that could be less, I'm going to make up dates, but you'll get the general idea. You can have Aseret B'Teves, let's say December, 26th, 1990, and then you can have it January 2nd, 1992. Huh. Right, so there could actually be a calendar year 1991 that didn't have a Aseret B'Teves in it. So that's the it's shy because it straddles a year. So when you have a leap year, you can have 380 days between the two Aseret B'Teves. They could actually be in three different years, so to speak. In other words, year one and year three, and you don't have it in year two. But okay. Because of utter base. That's right. That's right. Because when you have a leap year, when you have an utter sheni, the length of the year is 385 or 4 days. So that could actually get you into a whole other year towards the end of a year. Going from December of 1 year to January of the year following that, skipping to December of the next year. Just want to give again a little bit of history. You know, the makor. What is the source? The source of fasting is a pasuk in Zechariah. Zechariah says, Zechariah, remember, was the last of the Nevi'im, and he talked about the idea that there are four fast days that we observe to commemorate the Chorban of the Beis Hamikdash, and they're defined by their months. There is Tzom, Harevi, the fast of the fourth month. Now remember, all the months are counted from Nisan. So the fast of the fourth is the 17th of Tammuz, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz. The fast of the fifth month is Tisha B'Av. The fast of the seventh month, which is Tzom Gedalia. And the fast of the tenth month, which is Teves. So he's not the one that's telling you to fast. Rather, what he's saying is following. What he's saying is, these four fast days will become days of rejoicing and simcha when there is a Beis HaMikdash. But the fact that he's calling them fast days indicates there is a chiyuv to fast on those days. So these are called fasts midivrei kabbalah. Divrei kabbalah means from the Nevi'im. These are technically rabbinic fast days. They're not d'oraisas, but they're early rabbinics. These are enacted from the Nevi'im that we fast on these days to commemorate the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, obviously, the Pasuk is going in order of the Jewish calendar, counting from Nisan. So it's the fast of the fourth month, the fifth month, the seventh month, and the tenth month. But chronologically speaking, the first of these days is Aseret B'Teves. Why is that important? What happened in Aseret B'Teves? Because in Aseret B'Teves, Nebuchadnezzar began his siege against Jerusalem, culminating in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash 3 years later. So in terms of sequencing, Aseret B'Teves began the siege. 3 years later, on the 9th of Tammuz, Yerushalayim was broken into. And the reason we do the 17th is because in the second Beis HaMikdash, it was the 17th of Tammuz. So we don't want to have two fast days right next to each other, but in the first Mikdash was the 9th of Tammuz. 3 weeks later, or 1 month later, rather, was the 9th. And then, 3 months later, or 2 months later, a little less than 2 months later, was the assassination of Gedaliah, who was the governor that was appointed over Eretz Yisrael after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Actually, these are the four fast days that are associated with the Churban Beis HaMikdash. But, yeah.
So this is associated with the first Beis HaMikdash or second?
So it depends. Obviously, the Navi Zechariah is talking about the first Beis HaMikdash, but the Gemara Tell explains that except for Asara B'Teves, this is interesting, all the other, except for Asara and some Gedalia, Tammuz and Av have their analogs in the second Beis HaMikdash, because on the 17th of Tammuz is when the Romans broke into the city of Yerushalayim, and of course the 9th of Av was the day of the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash, just like the first Beis HaMikdash. But two of the fast days, Asara B'Teves, and have relevance to the first Mikdash, not the second Mikdash. Now, what's interesting is the Avudraham. Avudraham was one of the Rishonim, Rav David Avudraham. He wrote a lot on Tefillah and the like, and the Torah quotes him very often. The Avudraham says a very interesting Chiddush. He says that if Asara B'Teves would fall out on Shabbos, only that, we know if Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos, we of course don't fast. The only fast that's Stoka Shabbos is Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur is a Torah fast, and it is called the Shabbos Shabbos and the Shabbos of Shabboses. If any other fast falls out on Shabbos, we of course don't fast till the next day. But the Avudraham writes, the exception would be Asara B'Teves. If Asara B'Teves would fall out on Shabbos, we would fast even on Shabbos. Now, that's an untestable proposition. The reason that's untestable is because based on the Jewish calendar and based on the lengths of the months and based on when Rosh Hashanah is, Asara B'Teves can never fall out on Shabbos. Now, it is unique. It's the only fast that we fast on Friday. But the Avudraham says we would even fast on Shabbos. Where does he get that from? He gets them from the fact is the following. Just have to go back a little bit and go back and describe two Nevi'im who lived at the time of the Churban, Yecheskel and Yirmiyahu. But Yecheskel and Yirmiyahu lived in two different places. Yirmiyahu lived in Eretz Yisrael, and Yecheskel lived in Bavel. Now, why did Yecheskel live in Bavel? Because you have to remember that the exile of the Jewish people in the first Beis HaMikdash actually took place in three distinct stages. And I'm not talking about the exile of the 10 tribes. That was over 100 years before the Churban. I'm talking about the exile of the southern kingdom of Yehuda, which only had two tribes, Yehuda and Binyamin, plus many Kohanim and Levim. Stage one was Kibush. Nebuchadnezzar conquered the land of Israel and subjugated it. But at that point, Jews are still living in Eretz Israel. Stage two was 8 years later. 8 years later, Nebuchadnezzar exiled from Eretz Yisrael what you would call the aristocratic class, leaving only the impoverished and uneducated. Now, technically, this is called in the Book of Malachim the Galus of the Charash and the Maskir. So the Galus of the Charash and the Maskir occurred 8 years later. And 11, I'll go back to that, 11 years after that was the Churban and the Golus of most of the rest of the people. So we have Kibush, we have the Golus of the Charash and the Maskir, then we have the Churban Bias 11 years later. Now literally, Charash and Maskir means, the Charash means the carpenters, and Maskir means the locksmiths. What would Nebuchadnezzar have against carpenters and locksmiths? So the simple pshat in the pasuk is that he wanted to take away skilled laborers and craftsmen from Eretz Yisrael because they would be capable of making weapons and revolt. But Chazal actually have a drasha that Charash and Maskir refers to Talmidei Chachamim. That they are called Charash, because Charash also means unable to hear or speak, because when they spoke, nobody was able to add anything. It's like as if people were not able to hear any other svara. And maskir is they closed up all discussion. Which means 11 years before the Churban, the Talmidei Chachamim were exiled from Eretz Yisrael, and they were in Bavel. What was the purpose? The purpose was so that 11 years later, when the rest of the people came to Bavel, there already would be an organized Torah community. Okay, this wasn't the Nebuchadnezzar's Kavana, but Hashem arranged it that the Talmidei Chachamim and the aristocracy were exiled from Eretz, spiritual aristocracy, were exiled from Eretz Yisrael. Now, basically, the Jewish kings, there are three different Jewish kings, really, during this period. The conquest was under the reign of the Jewish king Jehoiakim. The first wave of exile was under the reign of his son, Jehoiachin, and therefore it's called the Golus of Jehoiachin, or Yechaniah, which is the same name. And the third and final wave was under his uncle, who was Jehoiakim's brother, Tzidkiyahu, and therefore the king at the time of the Churban was Tzidkiyahu HaMelech, and that is called Golos Tzidkiyahu. Okay, so it's important that you, I don't want to give you too many details to memorize, that's hard to, but it is important to be aware of the three stages. The Kibush, Bimei Jehoiakim, the Galus of Yechaniah of the Charesh and the Masker, and then the Chorban or the Galus of Tzidkiyahu, that was 11 years later. So, from the initial conquest of by Babylonia till the Chorban Beis Hamikdash was 19 years. 8 plus 11. Now, if you pass me that pasuk, pass me the chumash, please. With this, you can now understand in a much more vivid way a pasuk in Megillas Esther. Right now, remember, the story of Megillas Esther takes place in the 70 years of exile between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second, but after Babylonia has already been deposed and replaced by Persia. This is towards the end of the 70 years. So when the Megillah describes Mordechai, introduces Mordechai, who Mordechai is, so now you'll know what this means. In fact, we read this pasuk out loud. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan Habira. Right, there was a man in Shushan, Ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish Ishimini. That's the read we read from the tribe of Binyamin. Now the next pasuk we don't read out loud, but the Chazan reads it in the tune of Eicha. He switches tune from the Megillah trup to the Eicha trup, and it says, Asher heglam Yerushalayim, he was exiled from Jerusalem, im hagola asher haglosa, with the exiles who were exiled, im Yechaniya melech Yehuda, together with King Yechaniya. So now you know that Mordechai was exiled from Yerushalayim 11 years before the Churban, because Mordechai, as you would expect, was amongst the Charash and the Maskir. So basically, the way it worked was, Mordechai must have gone from Yerushalayim to Babylonia, because Persia wasn't the ruler then. And then, after the fall of Babylonia, where Persia became the capital, Mordechai went to Shushan, presumably to plead on behalf of his people and the like, and that is where the story of Purim happened. Now, Yecheskel HaNavi was amongst the Charash and the Masker who was in Babel. And that's why Yecheskel's Nebuas are all, essentially, in the 11-year period between the Golus of Jehoiachin and the Churban Beis HaMikdash, right? So Yecheskel is the Navi in Babel. However, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu took away most of the Talmidei Chachamim and brought them to Babel, he did not leave Eretz Yisrael bereft of spiritual leadership. The Navi Yirmiyahu remained in Eretz Yisrael, and the Navi Yirmiyahu personally experienced the Churban Beis HaMikdash. As we know, he wrote Megillas Eicha. So Yirmiyahu and Yecheskel are living exactly at the same time. They are prophesying at the same time. Yecheskel is the Navi who's already in Galus, and Yirmiyahu is the Navi that is experiencing those 11 years. Now Yirmiyahu died actually, we don't know exactly when Yecheskel died. Yirmiyahu died sometime after the Churban. We know Yirmiyahu personally experienced the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Yirmiyahu experienced the death of Gedaliah. And Yirmiyahu died shortly after the death of Gedaliah. although it's not recorded exactly when he died. Neither Yirmiyahu nor Yechezkel were zocha to see the building of the second Beis HaMikdash, which, you know, is logical anyway, because there would be, you know, a lot of years between, you know, 70 years between the destruction of the first and the destruction of the second. Okay, so seen in this way, understanding this, and whether Yeshayahu, who's the other great big prophet, right, these are the three big prophetic books, much earlier. Yeshayahu lived before the exile of the ten tribes. The ten tribes were exiled more than 100 years by Assyria. This is before the Babylonian conquest, right? So Yeshayahu lived way before the Churban Beis HaMikdash and way before the Babylonian conquest. Okay, in Yeshayahu's time, Babylon was not a power in the world. The world's power was Assyria. And everything in the book of Yeshayahu is about Ashur and not about Babel.
How did Yirmiyahu escape from getting taken over?
Well, Yirmiyahu actually, Nebuchadnezzar liked Yirmiyahu, and the reason is very interesting, because Yirmiyahu was constantly telling the Jewish people, do not rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, because Hashem will not protect you. The false prophets were telling the Jewish people, hey, you have the Beis HaMikdash, you're invincible, you can fight, have bitachon in Hashem. Yirmiyahu was giving them the true message from Hashem, that because you're not on a madrega, you're not going to win, and if you rebel against the Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to have Golus, and the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed. If you don't rebel, and you subjugate yourself to him, then perhaps he will allow you to keep the Beis HaMikdash. So Yirmiyahu was considered by his fellow Jews as a traitor, as an appeaser. The term that's used is quisling. Quisling, it's a phrase in English. Quisling was, I think, the prime minister of Norway, who kind of surrendered his country to the Nazis. So it's become a term of art that when somebody is willing just to give up to the enemy without a fight, they're called a quisling. I don't know if you've heard the expression. So Yirmiyahu was actually accused of being what we call a quisling, because he was the one that was bedafka saying, don't fight, surrender, don't make machlokas. And all of these the false Nevi'im were sounding like the religious, righteous people saying, we have to fight. Hashem is with us. Bitachon, emuna. But they were false prophets. And indeed, everything Yirmiyahu said came to pass, and everything they said did not come to pass. And because of this, though, Nebuchadnezzar actually liked Yirmiyahu, because Yirmiyahu was a loyalist, so to speak. And as a result, Yirmiyahu was given permission to remain in Eretz Yisrael, which he felt he needed to be, because he was there to give him. Somebody had to be a leader to the Jews that remained. Now, going back to this, again, this is a long digression to explain the Avudraham. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yechezkel in Babel. Now, Babel is modern-day Iraq, right? So Babel is like 1,000 miles away from Eretz Yisrael. He says to him, after Nebuchadnezzar... Now, remember, so one thing you said, Nebuchadnezzar beginning his siege against Jerusalem, right? You understand... By saying he began a siege against Jerusalem, we are not referring to a siege to conquer Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar had already conquered all of Eretz Israel. But what happened was, in those years, the Jews were rebelling against him. So he was going to squash that rebellion, which Yirmiyahu told them not to engage in. Okay, so it's not like he's coming from the outside and trying to conquer. He had already done that years before, but he is now squelching a rebellion. So at a time when that rebellion began, so Hashem told Yechezkel 1,000 miles away, write down on a piece of paper, be etzem hayom hazeh, on this very day, the king of Babel has begun his siege. In other words, this was a way of showing people that Yirmiyahu was a Nabi Emes, because he wrote down, without email, without internet, he wrote down on the 10th of Tevez, the siege began. And then months later, they get the news that the siege began on the 10th of Tevez. And Yechezkel pulled out the paper. So, this is what the Avudram says. The Avudram's argument is, every one of the other tragic days is defined really in terms of the month. Hashem doesn't say explicitly, fast on the ninth of Av. Hashem says, fast in the fifth month. Hashem doesn't say explicitly fast on the ninth of Tammuz or the 17th of Tammuz. He says fast in the fourth month. Tzom Gedalia, fast in the seventh month. Now, yes, we fast on particular days because that is when the event occurred. But since the chiyuv of the fast is expressed not in terms of the day, but in terms of the month, so therefore, if it falls out on Shabbos, we can change the day and fast another day. But Asara B'Teves is defined as Etzem Hayom Hazeh, on that very day. So the Avudram says, it is not defined in terms of month, it is defined in terms of day. Therefore the Avudram says, Lu Yitzur, if it would be that Asara B'Teves fell out on Shabbos, which it cannot based on our calendar, we would fast even on Shabbos because of the Lashon B'Yetzem Yom Hazeh. And he points out that B'Yetzem Yom Hazeh is the same Lashon the Torah uses for Yom Kippur. B'Yetzem, on that very day. B'Yetzem Yom Hazeh. Now, this is an interesting thing. It's not so logical, really, in terms of simple Svara, because L'Chaira Asara B'Teves does not commemorate a Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the culmination of this process. It is the Chorban Beis HaMikdash itself. And yet, on the day of the Chorban Beis HaMikdash itself, we will not fast when it falls out on Shabbos. Asara B'Teves, in fact, nothing happened on Asara B'Teves. In other words, Asara B'Teves was the day that the siege against Jerusalem began. Now, what happens on the day, it's hard for us to visualize exactly. What happens on the day that a siege begins? I mean, nothing happens. It basically means, I don't know myself exactly, the army got there. And they put a barricade around the wall. Now, people were not starving yet, because they had enough food for a while, right? All of the negative effects of the siege is with the prolongation of time. The day the siege begins is not necessarily a day in which people are suffering or people are dying or anything else. So it's a little strange, is it not, that the actual day of the Chorban of Tisha B'Av is not important enough to override Shabbos. And yet, the day that the siege began, in which there was nothing that necessarily happened to the Jewish people that day, that is going to be Docha Shabbos. Again, this is what the Avudram says. Now again, the idea would be, Chazal say that in retrospect, you look at the beginning of the process. This was the beginning of the process, and the beginning is especially bitter, because with the passage of time, you can get used to it. You already get used to this is going to happen. But that beginning was that notion that we're not invulnerable anymore. Hashem has removed his protection from us, and all sorts of things can happen. Now, as I say, the Avudram's proposition is not testable. Right? You remember that famous, I'm sure Rabbi Gottlieb must have mentioned it, it's a famous idea in science that the definition of a scientific principle as opposed to a non-scientific idea is falsibility. Meaning something can be called scientific only if there's some way to show that it's not true if a certain state of events happens. Meaning if I have a hypothesis, so I can say if so-and-so happens, this proves that it's incorrect. So then, if it doesn't happen, then I have proof that it's correct. But something that cannot be falsified under any conditions, no matter what happens, the idea might still be valid. Might be a true idea, but if it's not a falsifiable idea, it's not susceptible to being called science. Okay, this is a famous test of falsifiability as a definition of scientific idea. So, in a sense, the Avudram's idea in our prayer is non-falsifiable, because we never have Asara B'Teves on Shabbos. So we don't know what would happen if it would be on Shabbos. But this is his position, that indeed it would be Docha, even Shabbos. Now, another thing that's interesting about this is that Chazal actually say that there are three tragedies that took place on the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th of Teves, different years. And in reality, Asara B'Teves is not only a fast day for the tragedy of Asara B'Teves, but it's also a fast day for the tragedies of the 8th and 9th of Teves, as well, but Chazal did not want to enact a fast of three consecutive days, as one would understand. And now these are not in order, though. Chronologically, the tenth of Teves is the earliest of it. That is the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's siege against Yerushalayim. The second event, I always forget which is the eighth and which is the ninth, but the second event chronologically was the death of Ezra. Now, who was Ezra? Ezra has a book in Tanakh, the book of Ezra. And in fact, according to Chazal, Ezra and Nehemiah are one book. Although we have a book of Ezra and a book of Nehemiah, in fact, it's all called the book of Ezra. Ezra was a person who came to Eretz Yisrael at the beginning of the second Bayasheni, right? So he's after Mordechai. And Ezra was the one who organized the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. He was the religious leader who brought Torah and Emunah back to Klal Yisrael. And he was the head of the Anshei Knesset, the founder and the head of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. And in fact, Ad Kedei Kach, the Gemara says that Ezra was as worthy as Moshe Rabbeinu to be the one that would bring Torah to Am Yisrael. But the generation was not worthy, so it was given to Moshe's generation and not to Ezra's generation. So Ezra was considered to be a phenomenal tzaddik and leader of his people. And as a result, Chazal wanted to be koveya a fast on the day that Ezra died. Now, again, it's pretty amazing. We know Moshe Rabbeinu died on the 7th of Adar. And although there are some tzaddikim who do fast on the 7th of Adar, but there was never any thought that we would make a general fast day for the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. And yet, for the death of Ezra, there was actually a thought of making a fast day, which we fold into the 10th of Teves. So that's the second event, the death of Ezra. Now, the third event is after all of that, and this is already after the biblical period. This takes us to near the Hanukkah, and that is the Persian Empire was replaced by the Greek Empire. And I remember, I think we talked last week about the Ptolemaic dynasty of Egypt versus the Seleucid dynasty in Syria, which I think we talked about that. So under the Ptolemaic dynasty, you'll recall, which is after the death of Alexander the Great, so Ptolemy, they're all called Ptolemy. There's Ptolemy the First and Ptolemy the Hundredth. You know, they all went by the same name. But one of the Ptolemaic monarchs had a library in Alexandria, and it was actually one of the seven wonders of the world, in the ancient world. The library was the ancient Library of Congress. They wanted to have a copy of every book in the world. No, there weren't that many books then as now. But one of the books they wanted the Torah. So this is the story that the Gemara records, that they commissioned 70 elders to translate the Torah into Greek. And the elders were put into different rooms to see if they would come up with the same translation. And through Ruach HaKodesh, they came up with exactly the same translation. They made certain changes in the word sequence that could give rise to misunderstandings. And this was the earliest public translation of the Torah into another language. Now, I had mentioned that the Jews in Alexandria considered that day to be a holiday. The day that this is called the Septuagint. Targum. Septuagint is just Greek for the translation of the 70. So in Hebrew, it's called Targum Shivim. And in scholarly literature, if you want to be a biblical scholar, when archaeologists refer to it, they call it the LXX. LXX, just Roman numerals for 70. Right? According to the LXX. Now, so you can impress people with that. Now, the thing is that the Septuagint, although it was written by Chachamim, but it did not really become part of the Messiah of Torah Shebaal Peh. So, for example, the Septuagint is not used by Chazal as a source of halacha or understanding. And there are psukim, which the Septuagint interprets keneged the Messiah of Chazal. So the Septuagint has had virtually no influence on halacha and on Yiddishkeit. But the Septuagint was very, very influential in the Christian understandings of the Torah, because Greek was the dominant language. All of the early Christian fathers did know Hebrew. Many of them knew Hebrew. But Greek was their first language, by and large. Greek was the common language then. And therefore, a lot of the Christian understandings of the so-called Old Testament come through the Septuagint. It was much more important in the history of Christianity than it is in the history of Judaism. The Septuagint was not used by Chazal, as far as we know. Chazal used the Targum Onkelos, the Aramaic Targumim, which were written according to the guidance of the Tanoim, but they did not use the Greek translations of the Torah. Now, I mentioned that Alexandria was a very assimilated community, and as a result, there's some evidence that even the Kriyas HaTorah was done in Greek. That's why the Gemara in Megillah talks about, can you write a Torah scroll in Greek? Do you ever come across that Gemara? Very strange Gemara. But the answer was, for those communities, that may have been what they did. But Chazal say the following. The day that the 70 elders finished the Targum, 3 days of darkness came upon the world. They finished around the 9th of the 8th of Teves. So the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th were days of darkness. So it turns out that the three tragedies of the Asar B'Teves period are the beginning of the siege against Jerusalem, the next one was the death of Ezra, and the third one, which happened either on the 8th or the 9th of Teves, was the completion of this translation. And Chazal considered that to be a great, great tragedy. What's the great tragedy about it, right? Why is it a tragedy? So there are a few different reasons. One reason is, it was a tragedy that so many Jews were so assimilated that they had to learn the Torah through a translation, as opposed to being able to go back to the Hebrew and read it. Now that's an interesting point. I remember when the Art Scroll series started in 1981. Really, it's quite phenomenal. I think I mentioned this, maybe mentioned this before. You know, the editor of Art Scroll is Rabbi Zlatowitz. Rabbi Zlatowitz and Rabbi Nelson Sherman. But Rabbi Zlatowitz. Now, Art Scroll was, I think it still is, was an invitation company. They did wedding invitations. And Rabbi Zlatowitz was a graphic artist. I mean, he had smicha, but, you know, he was a graphic artist. A close friend of his died in 1980, Rabbi Meir Fogel. So he thought, as a memorial to his friends, he would do an anthology of commentaries on Megillas Esther. A one-time thing on Megillas Esther. Like a 150-page thing on Megillas Esther. L'zecher nishmasa. And that was his whole kavanah. His kavanah was, he's going to go back to the invitation business, and he's going to do a little anthology of Megillas Esther. And of course, once he did Megillas Esther, people said, well, what about some other Megillas? But again, he had no kavanah to expand it. Now, what then happened, of course, is the invitation is still a division of Art Scroll. Art Scroll has like an invitation division, but now, obviously, it's turned into an amazing thing. With the all of Shas. I mean, look at that, Shas, and now Yerushalmi, and now Medrash. And, of course, they fund all this with the Siddur. You know, the way your business works is, you know, as wonderful as the Shas is, they don't really sell enough Shases to cover the tremendous cost of putting the Shas together. But they do have a thing like the Siddur and the Chumash are their, they generate all of their income, not all, but much of their income from the Siddur and the Chumash, and that covers everything else, and the like. So really, it's phenomenal. Now, you know, people love to criticize Art Scroll, they make fun of Art Scroll, and they say this and that, and, you know, okay, listen, there are all sorts of things that, Art Scroll does right, and all sorts of things Art Scroll does wrong. But one cannot deny the tremendous, tremendous, phenomenal contribution to Harbatzas Torah that they've made. You know, in terms of Dafyomi, for example, you know, Dafyomi certainly has maybe quadrupled or even more so, almost solely because there's an Art Scroll Shas, so people can look at the Shas now and, you know, whatever it is. So it's easier for them to learn Gemara. I know the official Art Sameach, you're not supposed to look at Art Scroll, so, you know, I'm not telling you to look at Art Scroll, but nevertheless, it's very helpful in some cases. Now, here's the thing. So I remember in 1981, when Art Scroll first came out, so people were saying what a wonderful thing it is that now we could see the Mefarshim in English. So somebody wrote in a letter to the Jewish Observer reminding us that the day that they finished the Torah in Greek was not considered a happy day, it was considered a sad day. Because even if it was necessary, something can be necessary and tragic at the same time. It's necessary, and it was something we had to have, But we're very, very sad that we had to happen, that the Amaratzis was so strong that people could not learn the Torah in its original language. So that's one reason why there was sadness. Another reason looks at it in terms of the Umos HaOlam. By translating the Torah into Greek, or any language, you've now made it accessible to the nations of the world who could put in their distortions, and they could put in all sorts of arguments, right? In other words, in a sense, it was better to keep the Torah away from the scrutiny of the Umos HaOlam, could put in different interpretations. Right, so that's the second reason why it was considered to be a negative thing. Now, the third, which may not apply to our scroll, might have been that Chazal were concerned with some of the references in that particular Targum that were against Halacha. So in a sense, that was a translation that had certain halachic irregularities, which created a certain problem. But be it as it may, it turns out that the fast of Asara B'Teves is a cumulative fast, meaning to say we are fasting not only because of the beginning of the siege, but because of these two other events as well. And in fact, if you look at the Slichos of Asara B'Teves that we're going to recite Friday morning, you will actually see a reference to the 3 days of suffering which Asara B'Teves is supposed to represent. Okay. Yeah, I have to separate. We'll continue in 10 minutes.
There were three stages to the first exile. And
yes.
The thing with Gedalia, is that like a fourth or part of the third?
Which one?
The whole affair with Gedalia. Was that part of the third?
No, Gedalia is the final act of the third.
The final act of the third.
Because, like this, the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. But a small number of Jews were still permitted to live in Eretz Yisrael under the autonomy of their own governor, Gedalia. So it was thought that perhaps Hashem would have rachamim, and if that would have been successful, we'd be able to build the Beis Hamikdash. So the nail was driven into the coffin with the death of Gedalia. So that's considered to be a hemshich of the third of the Korban.